The Triangle Below Canal Street, 2026, AKA Tribeca.
It puts the tri in Tribeca.
We're putting the tri in Tribeca.
It's an uncommonly warm evening in February, and we're gonna do another Gonzo movie theater episode. Tonight, a super inspired double feature. We're so lucky in New York City to be able to see films in rare formats.
Yes.
And so we're going into the super analog and into the super high tech tonight.
That's right, we got a 3-hour and 8-minute Robert Altman film, Shortcuts on 35 millimeter, Glorious 35. And then we've got a brand new Sam Raimi release, Send Help, and we're gonna be seeing it in 4DX, Ray.
And we're gonna really be addressing, I'm gonna be taking scrupulous notes. What is the 4DX doing at every given moment in every sequence of the film? What's it adding? What's the symphonic layer that is contributed by the beautiful technology?
What is the score? What's the score of the motion? What's the score of the water, hopefully? Maybe some smells?
Yeah. Can I ask you, Jordan, what is your relationship with Shortcuts? When did you first see this movie? When was the last time you saw this movie?
I have not seen this movie in some time. For me, it's definitely, I don't think I've seen this movie on Blu-ray. I think I saw this movie in the DVD era. And I would say my main relationship to it, honestly, is just in all the comparisons that were made between it and Magnolia.
Yeah.
Julianne Moore and a whole bunch of other characters rocking and rolling in an ensemble way. So yeah, I think I heard about Shortcuts long before I saw it, because I was very into those late 90s auteurs. When I did see it, I think I was pretty confused by it, honestly. I'm excited to see the movie with maybe slightly older, more adult life eyes. I'm also excited to see it after having read a chunk of the Raymond Carver short stories that it's based on. I didn't read all of them, Ray. You read?
I read all 9. Yeah, I got this 900-page collection of all the Raymond Carver short stories, and I went and I read the 9 that the film is based off of. And it was devastating.
Yeah.
They're all about 5 pages long, but it was like receiving a series of concussive punches to the soul.
He really thrives on the downbeat. They're not a lot of happy endings. Although, I will say, let's get into it after the movie.
Yeah.
I think one of the stories has a slightly major chord at the end of it than I expected based on my memory of the movie.
Oh, for sure. The main connection I feel to the White Sea is, first off, actors. Fran McDormand. Anything that has a Fran McDormand performance this big, I feel, is Coen's adjacent and To the White Sea adjacent. But then you also have Tim Robbins, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Julianne Moore.
And Tom Waits.
And Tom Waits.
Yeah.
So this film is 1993, so it comes out in between Barton Fink and Hudsucker Proxy.
That's right.
You really are getting Jennifer Jason Leigh, Fran McDormand. They all look exactly like they look in those movies. Long Goodbye is such a huge influence. They've always cited that. Robert Altman's films in general. I read the stories and was really it was really fun to read the stories first and then to peek into the movie and be oh, who's playing who? There's these awesome characters. Yeah. I read the short story, is what a great short story. And then found out those characters are played by Lily Taylor and young Robert Downey Jr. I was this is awesome.
I love Lily Taylor so much.
I'm in a huge Lily Taylor appreciation phase right now. My main actors are Lily Taylor, Bob Hoskins, pre Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh yeah. Have you seen the Long Good Friday?
That's one of the ones I just have recently enjoyed. That and Mona Lisa.
Isn't that such an incredible movie?
Yes.
I love that movie because it's made in 1980, but somehow it knows how to be the most 80s movie ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it just announces to the world, the 70s are over. This is how the 80s are gonna be.
Okay, we're starting our journey. We're in Tribeca.
Just one other little Coen's connection. Scruggs is another way to do a book of short stories.
Yes.
As a movie. And I do feel Tom Waits as a late entrant into the Coen's troop of actors. That feels like a connection. Powerhouse Tom Waits performance right in the middle of your short story collection movie.
Absolutely. We read the short stories because it's a really interesting example of an adaptation. like Scruggs, like To the White Sea.
Yeah.
In this case, Tom Waits is kind of jumping in, I feel, as a representative of the Jim Jarmusch filmmaking world. It's kind of like a super team movie in that you have like Andy McDowell recently from Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
That's right, yeah.
Frances McDormand coming in from the Coen's films. Yeah. Like, just basically, it's everyone who was a cool actor at the time all just fitting into this enormous ensemble.
Yeah, the whole like late 80s, early 90s boomlet, obviously before Tarantino, I guess before Kevin Smith, a specific coterie of acting talent coming through to not get hit by an e-bike. No, to like kind of big up and support one of the old masters. Like, I don't know if you would call, like, was Altman working independently? He pretty much worked in the studio system.
I mean, this is the post-Player movie. So yeah. The Player was this huge comeback hit.
Yeah.
And this is the one he made directly after. And it's this awesome approach to taking Raymond Carver's work and combining a bunch of the characters, compositing a bunch of the characters, interlocking the storylines from stories that were previously unconnected to create this, like, remind me very much of that Simpsons episode, the 22 short films about Springfield.
Yeah.
Film that just jumps in time and place. Really feels like it sets the stage for Magnolia, but also Pulp Fiction. Also, I don't think you get Crash.
No.
Shortcuts.
No, none of those hyperlink movies.
And I would even argue that the LA of Shortcuts just feels very much like the LA of Big Lebowski. Those characters really feel like they could fit into this world.
Yeah, it's like a little bit more suburban, like the neighborhood where Goodman goes to interrogate Larry. Feels like a neighborhood that could be in Shortcuts, right?
Absolutely.
In the intro to the Shortcuts book, Altman rattles off a list of names and he's like, this isn't like Hollywood, Los Angeles. This is like Watts. What's your relationship to Los Angeles?
I lived there for a while when I was a kid and I've lived there as an adult a handful of times. And I really love it. And I really love movies like this that really forefront strip malls and people's houses and people wearing kind of soft clothes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This very like downbeat residential aspect of the city that I love to see because it just feels so emotionally raw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a quick passage in one of the short stories where a woman puts on a wool slacks and a sweater, and I'm like, that just sounds very specifically like an LA lady's outfit. My relationship to LA is that my brother lives there. So I've never lived in Los Angeles. I find it very difficult to understand. Every time I go there, I feel like I understand it 1% more. Although the last time I was there, I did feel like I could ride the buses, honestly.
Yeah.
Mass transit there is a little bit underrated. The buses actually run. You can get places if you just have to budget the time. I don't know. Yeah, but that's always been the big blocker for me is like, you know, I drove in high school, I drove in college, but never liked it. And once I moved to the city full time, did not really keep up with my driving skills. I guess we're the opposite that way too, because you've actually, you've gotten good.
I love driving. I got my driver's license when I was 33. And I especially love driving in Los Angeles and listening to music super loud. It's an incredible experience. So we're down in Tribeca. We're going to watch Shortcuts, which is 3 hours and 8 minutes at the Roxy. Then we're going to go uptown to Times Square, to the Regal Theater, to the 4DX Theater.
Yeah, we had to make it a Regal. Usually I do an AMC, but I got to do a Regal because 4DX.
We're doing 4DX. We're seeing Sam Raimi's Send Help, a film which neither of us have seen yet, and chase our Shortcuts experience with a Send Help experience. And then we're gonna hang out and talk afterwards and try to draw some prismatic connections, perhaps between the two films.
If we can find them, yeah.
We explained the connections between Shortcuts and Coen's before, but with Sam Raimi, it really needs no explanation. He's came out of the same primordial soup with the Coen's.
He's got part of their brain in his brain.
And we're just, you know, super excited to see a Sam Raimi film that is not a sequel and not a superhero movie.
Yeah.
Just like a very like auteur horror film. Love Drag Me to Hell, obsessed with Evil Dead films. And also I'm a huge Castaway fan, which this film seems to be riffing on enormously.
Absolutely.
So would love to see, that film is such a cool clockwork contraption where everything fits together perfectly. So I'd love to see Raimi get his hands on something like that and twist it. Okay, so we've been walking through Tribeca, but now we're outside the Roxy. It's a glittery evening in New York City, and we're going to go in and enjoy this perfect film. Right, Jordan?
I would call it, well, let's see, you know?
Yeah.
I would call it probably a perfect film.
A work by one of the masters.
One of the greats.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the greats. All right, see
you on the other side.
Dog sneeze outside. I've told you 100 times.
Don't put Susie outside. They're spraying. It's going to give her cancer.
It's not going to give her cancer. Don't you get environmental on me, Sherry.
Have you listened to the news lately?
So virtual reality is practically totally real, but not.
I'm going to like somebody.
Where are you going, Gene?
Out.
This is the third night this week, Gene.
Going further.
He's playing around. I can smell it on him.
Was born to be free.
Can we have a little more butter, please?
Coming up.
I came home, I told Earl her whole life could change. Earl tells me to go on a diet.
I'll find a way to keep.
Well, this house is half mine, you know.
Is that a joke?
Lady, I work 16 hours a day to make ends meet.
Yeah.
I bake all night and work all day.
I thought you made phone calls at night.
I said, Ola, if I have one more beer, I'm going to have to take a nap. And she says, I wondered what it would take to get you into bed.
Do you think he's attractive?
Who?
He kissed you, didn't he? I want to know the truth.
We're just talking, right?
Yes, Marion, we're just talking.
How long are you going to do that? Do you know what time it is?
To hell with love. To hell. Forget what other people do when it comes to me and you. To hell with love.
Did I do something wrong, officer?
Take your sunglasses off, ma'am. One more question. How many clowns can you fit in this car, ma'am?
When it comes to you and me, that's the way it's gonna be. If you share my point of view, I'm the woman made for you. When it comes to push or shove, if you're holding out for love.
These are strange people, honey.
To hell with love.
How about that shortcut?
Okay, tour de force.
Transcendent. Absolutely transcendent experience. We're just starting from the Coen Brothers.
We just left the theater.
We just left the theater.
We're going to walk uptown.
Just to give you a sense of timing, this was a 6 p.m. shortcuts, which took us till about, what, 9:15?
Yeah.
It's a 3-hour and 8-minute movie plus like a little trailer stuff. Now we're walking uptown to Times Square, where we're going to see an 11 p.m. showing of Send Help. But shortcuts, to the matter at hand, shortcuts. I think you're totally right about the Lebowski connection.
Yeah. Like, what'd you see?
Yeah, the setting, obviously, but like Julianne Moore's art studio. This has come up on the show when we've talked about Lebowski and Boogie Nights come out something like within a year of each other.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
There's no way that those movies could have actually influenced each other, but they seem so spiritually connected.
Yeah.
And I think Shortcuts really is the answer, which is just young PTA and the Coens both saw that movie and freaked out a little bit and wrote some stuff.
Well, you know, the Coens are huge Altman fans. They must have been excited that Fran McDormand and a bunch of their other friends had cool parts in this movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no top or bottom to this movie, I feel like. Like, there's no simple way to start with it.
Yeah.
But you'll like this analogy, because you like Legos.
Yeah.
Having read 5 of the stories, and you read all of them, just kept thinking about the Carver stories as, like, when you get a Lego set, and then on the back, there's, like, these crazy-looking contraptions, and it's just like, it says on the back of the box, you could also make this.
Yeah.
And they don't actually give you the instructions for how to make them, but it's all the pieces that's in the box all put together in this really wackadoodle confabulation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But so you're saying in Shortcuts, it's like we're looking at versions of the short stories from the Raymond Carver books, but they're like the versions that would be on the back of a Lego box?
They're like the alt version
yeah.
of the Lego set.
Okay, so can we start talking about, just from the short stories, how you're seeing the short stories getting adapted into like classic? Because it really feels like a Robert Altman film as much as it feels like a Raymond Carver short story. It's almost like an equal balance, you know?
I would even say more Altman than Carver.
Yeah, maybe.
In a lot of ways. Although key beats, you know, crucial character details and crucial story elements are directly out of it. So since you've read all of them and I've only read some of them, could I just like quiz you on like what some things from the movie that are like whether they're in the short stories as you see it?
Yeah.
Alex Trebek.
No.
No.
No, that was awesome. The tension, the seed being planted in the first scene of Alex Trebek's very realistic presence in this community. And then the husband's displeasure as she passive aggressively has gotten the electric Jeopardy game.
Yeah.
But the end is amazing.
A truly ominous shot of a board game box.
The camera zooms in. The film is all pans and zooms. You know, it's like classic Robert Altman stuff, but there's this really dramatic zoom in on a electric Jeopardy home board game.
Another quiz, if I can.
Yeah.
The spraying of the from the helicopter.
Yeah.
Is that in the short story?
No, and that's the stuff. It's like the Medfly spraying and the earthquake kind of add together to be the falling frogs from Magnolia.
Yeah.
I feel. It's like, it's so clear that it's like a translation, but I forgot about the earthquake. I remembered the Medfly thing being this unifying kind of natural event blanket over everyone, but I forgot about the earthquake at the end. Is there an earthquake in Crash?
You know, that's a great question.
Yeah.
Didn't Mark Isham do the music in Crash?
I don't know.
I think he did. And I always sort of saw that name, and I'm like, seeing this movie, oh, Jesus.
Okay, so we're now walking down the street in Tribeca that's completely flooded. The cobblestones are covered with like an inch or 2 inches of water.
I fully didn't see it and stepped right in it.
Jordan, you want to tell us about when we got into the movie theater, what happened when we were trying to find our seats in the dark theater?
Yeah, a little bit of a debacle. I was like, the seats are 17 and 18. And I just looked at it. I just stared at it so many times being like, I guess these seat numbers go from zero to X and you just have to count them up. So we sat in the back of the theater and then Ray zoomed in on the QR code. And of course he realized what I didn't, which is that, sorry, we're dealing with the earthquake of New York City, which is gallons of water getting pumped off of snowbanks into the cobblestone street. It's like literally untraversable.
We left the Roxy. We're walking north through Tribeca. We're very much in the neighborhoods from like After Hours, or if you've seen the film Unfaithful.
I feel like we're in that movie Reminiscence. You remember that movie? Scenes of it are in the future. New York City's flooded.
We're looking for seats 17 and 18 in the dark and saw there was seats I-8 and I-7.
Yeah. You know why there's no 8 train? There's no 8 train because it sounds like A train. Likewise, I think there should be no row I. It wasn't my bad. I feel bad.
That's on the Roxy.
I never feel bad about anything I do. I'm not shame-ridden or anything. Okay, what were you talking about?
We were just talking about differences between the short stories and the film.
Yeah.
Really, a lot of what they're doing is they're combining. So they're doing stuff like Robert Downey Jr. and Lily Taylor are playing the couple in Neighbors, and that whole thing where they, in this one, their apartment sitting and feeding the fish. In the book, it's that their apartment sitting and feeding a cat.
Yeah.
And that story is actually amazing. It's he's sneaking into the house and spending too long in their apartment. He's trying on the guy's clothes. He's trying on the woman's clothes. And then she's like, why are you taking so long? And then she starts to go into the apartment and she's spending too long in there. And then they both just get locked out. And it ends with them just locked out in the hallway. And this is a really beautiful ending. In this story, their story just keeps going, and they combine it with this other short story that ends with that really vicious murder up on the mountaintop where Chris Penn bludgeons the girl with the rock. But those are two totally separate characters in the short stories that they combine. Similarly, like the whole so much water, so close to home, the story about the guys fishing and finding the dead body.
Yeah.
That's all told after the fact in the short story. It's all just about after the guy comes home and the news finding out and his wife just being so upset with him. And in this one, they combine it. Those guys become the guys who are asking Lily Tomlin to get more butter at the opening. That's like another one. They combine two short stories. It's like, why can't the guys from that story also play this role in the other story?
Yeah, I think that short story was called They're Not Your Husband.
Yeah.
And those guys who are not her husband become the guys who go on the fishing trip, which also really reminds me of Deliverance, another movie we've talked about.
Yeah, so much like Deliverance. Just not wanting a tragedy to ruin the trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The shots of the woman underwater are just so upsetting, but also so painterly. I wonder how they... That must have just been a dummy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The movie makes you think about special effects makeup, too, because you have a character who does that stuff. Okay, so just one more. I don't know. This is the last quiz question. Is there phone sex stuff in any of the shorts?
Not that I remember, but, you know, I only just read them once.
Yeah.
But not that I remember. There's a lot at it, basically. Like, these short stories are usually 5 pages long, and really they're excellent for adaptation because they're very events happen. And characters have reactions to the events, but they're mostly just about one event happening each story, and then just kind of cuts out right at the kind of perfect moment.
I'll have 2 root beers, please, man.
But it's not precious. Like, even when Lyle Lovett says, eating is a good thing at a time like this, you're like, Jesus Christ, the title of the story is A Small Good Thing, and the line is, eating is a small good thing at a time like this. It's like, they don't really care.
No. Before we recorded, and I said, one of these stories ends happier than is going to in the film, I completely made up an ending where Lyle Lovett, like, comes to the funeral and, like, runs riot with the cake.
What?
I was sure that was the ending of the movie.
He just shows up to the funeral for the child
with a giant cake. But he's like, here's your fucking cake.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then I was thinking, and I don't know what movie I was thinking of, but that's how little I remembered from this movie. No, because the ending of that is very similar.
That story is beautiful. We both had I was gutted.
Unbelievable.
By the story, A Small Good Thing, which is really just so much about people being so nervous while waiting for their son in the hospital that they just don't eat. They can't eat the entire story.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the story, you have just felt the experience of having no appetite and being so dead inside your own body for so long with these characters going through these ups and downs and these false hopes that they get from the doctor. And by the end, when their son is dead and the guy makes them the cinnamon rolls and they describe putting butter on the cinnamon rolls and eating them in the dawn, it's just so earthy and like
warm, kind of. Weirdly cathartic.
Emotional in this total body way.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I had a similar emotional reaction to this, reading that story. Both just the sort of all of the good things about it, mainly like the way the characters are constantly trying to connect with each other and are just almost strangers to each other. Like all that stuff that people say about American literature and rendering of modern American society. But it's just so fucking good. And the prose is so simple.
Well, you read that. I sent you that Onion thing, that Ask Raymond Carver Onion thing, which I think is kind of devastating. It's so funny. I mean, it makes me like Raymond Carver more, but it's also like,
unbelievable. You want to tell people what this is?
It's just ask Raymond Carver as an advice column, and basically
it's a 2002 Onion, so it's like sweet spot of the Onion.
Yeah, you know this was written by one of the like
an old, Academy Award winning screenwriter. Yeah.
I was also just kind of mourning and self-flagellating a little bit just about how little prose I read just on a daily basis. I don't want to belabor it, but I would just say, go read a Raymond Carver short story. Go read any short story. Like, just the ability of a few words to put you in someone's headspace that's not your own, or even just to have an author's brain power your brain for a few minutes is wonderful and totally different from movies. And we should be doing it more. Thinking about why this movie is 3 hours and 8 minutes, I completely understand, because when we have an episode that's 3 hours and 8 minutes, it's because we tried to do 9. And I think that's kind of this, is like just, you really could have made a much more, and I'm not criticizing Shortcuts at all, although it is incredible that short is in the title.
Yeah.
You could have made a very functional movie with 5 of these. Or a very traditionally satisfying Hollywood film if you had done 5 instead of 9. But it's way better. There's no getting your arms around it. Like, I want to know how much the... Because I didn't read the script of this. I want to know how much the inner cutting was done on the page.
How much they knew when they were going to jump.
Because it's so flowy, and it's also way more cutting between things than I expected, or than I remembered.
It's so funny, because the whole movie, like, and most of his movies, he'll just decide to, like, put the camera in one spot and then pan and zoom in.
Yeah.
Just to find the shots, and then it's like what you can hear is almost supernatural. Like, you could, like, you'll be down with Chris Penn in the pool, and then you, like, look up and you see through the window, and that Lady Zoe is playing the cello, and all of a sudden you can hear the cello as good as she can hear it. But then there are moments where there's dollies.
Yeah.
Like, there are these really, really hyper, really hyper effective dolly moves, because there's nothing like them in the rest of the movie. The ones I noticed was when she first can't wake up her son, there's this big move in.
Especially because we've been doing zooms for that.
Yeah.
Throughout that whole chapter.
Yeah.
And then the moment where she can't wake him up, we actually push and go closer.
Yeah. But then also when Jack Lemmon blew the egg from one shot glass to another, there was like really, really crazy dolly move.
That one I didn't notice. That's great.
What do you think's going on there?
He has some moves in it. He like Three Women had some dolly moves.
Yeah.
And I haven't watched all of his movies that closely, but I feel like The Player has some crane stuff for sure. He's not like as much as he has a style, he's not like Ozu, you know? Like, it's not like he's so rooted in his technique. It just seems like he was getting to set and making those choices depending on what felt good. Like, Allman does have great close-ups.
There's great close-ups in this movie. Matthew Modine has great close-ups.
Oh yeah. The poem Lemonade. Poem Lemonade, which is called a poem. Oh, that really reads like prose to me. It's a short.
Reads like a 2-page short story.
That was published in The Atlantic. But very trippy, very, like, kind of the most zen thing that I read. It's basically about a grandfather explaining to someone whose house he's fixing that his son, the main contractor, can't come out because his grandson died.
Yeah, drowned.
Drowned, and that his son sort of got obsessed with the idea that, or was it the grandfather who got obsessed with the idea that he shouldn't have sent the kid back for lemonade, because it would have changed.
They're basically thinking about, like, everything that had happened, even the fact that the whole area had been irrigated in order to create the lemons that were in the lemonade.
Yeah.
It was like, it was his fault for buying the lemonade, because the fact that the lemons were being produced in that area was what caused the river to be there, which is what caused his son to drown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even fully follow that.
Yeah. It's almost like your consumer guilt is what leads to the death of your kid.
And there's a crazy image in that about like a like sort of like salad tongs attached to a helicopter going underwater to pick the kid up.
Yeah.
And when I was watching this movie, I was like, is there gonna be a scene where one of those helicopters reaches down and picks the body up from the river or something? Like,
why do you think that lemonade was included in the collection of nine? Does that stuff show up?
That's what I can't figure out. Jack Lemmon,
when he's talking to Bruce Davidson about, I'm sorry I let you, because he's talking to him about him drowning as a kid, right?
Yeah, or that he almost drowned, it was in the hospital.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, or maybe it was just Lemmon, you know, decision to cast Jack Lemmon. Come on.
What? Oh, just the, I didn't get it.
I thought you were just being like, enough with the jokes.
No, I didn't, I just fully didn't get it.
No, just the, you know, the choice to cast Jack Lemmon, that's enough. For the lemon motif. Oh man, we got a lot of blocks to cover. We're at 10th Street now. We're looking at this beautiful church.
There's a little crook in Broadway. It goes straight up until 10th Street, and then there's a little diagonal bend. And right there is this beautiful white stone church, which always looks totally out of place.
And right next to the church, of course, the Hell House, the Halloween store, where I have gone to get some revisions on October 30th.
Yeah, also awesome when Tim Robbins, whose character is not a cop in the stories, like that Tim Robbins story is very much like expands out into the movie and sprawls into all these other characters' stories because he is a cop especially.
Yeah.
But like in the book, it's really just a guy with a job who takes the dog that's annoying him and loses it on purpose. And then has to go get the dog and bring it back. Like, that's his whole arc. But making him a cop means that, like, when he's going to get the dog, he can, like, run into Huey Lewis, who's the guy from the Fisher story.
Yeah.
Oh, another huge thing in the book, like, when the boy gets hit by the car, the person driving the car is not a character. They never get out of the car. They never talk to him. They just drive away. So
it's making, hit and run. And I also, in my memory, when I saw Tom Waits' character show up with that, driving that limousine, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. Tom Waits is going to hit that kid with the limousine.
Yeah.
But very, very interesting choice to make it Lily Tomlin and also to make her not run away, which wouldn't be in her character's nature, but to try to help the kid. I'm sorry, but if I was her, I would like just not stop. Like, I just, there's no way you let that kid walk away, but I guess I'm a better person.
Yeah, the way that whole scene plays out, it's kind of incredible because all from that one angle and you see him walking and then he just kind of steps out into the street unexpectedly. And I don't know how they got the kid to do a stunt that good, because it really looks like the kind of fall that would give you a concussion. And he really is just a little kid walking away from the camera. And the way that it's all done in that one shot, even then with her then walking with him and being like, are you okay? And that, like, all that is so beautifully performed in that one take.
And I think mainly it's just a long lens, so you can't see how close the car is, but it's visceral. Like, it's just really interesting for like a guy who maybe gets a reputation of like not sticking the landing on certain things or like just not caring about stuff like that. Like that, it's kind of the perfect example of Altman nailing it, where it's like it is all one shot, camera's not moving a lot, but you see exactly what you need to see to be like rocked by it.
And it just couldn't be more confusing and disturbing. It's like, how bad was that? How much of it just small accident was that? How much of a just like a total crisis?
Yeah, that is the one thing about reading the book ahead of time is people were laughing at that scene and a lot of the stuff with the kid.
people were riotously laughing at the beginning of the kid's story, and I was just like, oh, you guys are in for it.
You have no idea.
You're not
emotionally prepared for what's gonna happen. And that's another example too of like being very very free and very creative with the way that they bleed things together, but then the shot of the kid opening his eyes, or also Modine's performance as the doctor,
feels
like he studied that text. I know, I'm sure all the actors did, but his characterization as the doctor is just like so lifted from the page.
Well, it's funny. So he's the doctor in that story, and he's doing all the same stuff where he's just like, it seems normal, but I don't know. We need more time.
Yeah.
We just need to do more tests, like go home, take care of yourself, all that stuff. And that's the only dimension of him that you see in the story. But like in the movie, you can kind of add like, oh, he's just super distracted because he's obsessing about this thing that happened with his artist wife like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
That he can't get over. So it does, it adds just a, I feel like the impression you get of him in the book is just of a good doctor who's just didn't, like, whose tools weren't good enough to handle the process, whereas is in this one, you're just like, just kind of throwing a tantrum.
It's really interesting that once he goes home, you don't really see the after effects of that, of what happened to him at the hospital.
Yeah.
Like, obviously he does throw the tantrum and he's not in a great mood, but for me, I think the power of that is you get the impression that doctors lose patients every day, and it's just something that they don't, that's not necessarily at the front of their mind, even if it's something horrible like that.
Well, it's like, why isn't he there when the son does die? Is it his shift is over and he's just back being a civilian?
Oh, you know, I didn't realize that. Because in the book, he's very much like, oh, we didn't know it was this.
Yeah.
There's no way we could have known, all the tests were like this. And he shakes the dad's hand, which is a really well, you could almost see that. You could kind of see that note for note in the movie.
Yeah.
But it's not in the movie.
No.
Yeah.
Another thing too that they changed is that family of the kid who got stabbed or shot, who's next door to them. Like in the story, he dies. And in this one, he lives and the dad's like, oh, Matthew Modine, you're such a lifesaver. Like almost to like kind of counterbalance it more, just be like, no, he is good at his job. He's not just a guy who's like blowing everything right now.
I clocked that too, and I thought that was a curious choice.
Well, man, that was the ending. That was the one happy ending that we got, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they felt like they were stacking everything. Like maybe a concern. And obviously the concern for this movie would be you throw that in and then you're still also trying to do like just like pratfalls in the other strands. But I think it all plays somehow, which is really a magic trick.
I loved, you know, I'm going through my Lily Taylor phase, but I love this Lily Taylor and Lily Tomlin as mother-daughter. Those scenes of the two of them talking together and just the sounds of their two voices.
It would be great to see them in a movie together again.
Yeah, the shots of Lily Taylor looking at the fish through the kind of like plexiglass crystals.
Yeah.
Looked beautiful on 35. I think the 35 really added to the experience tonight for the kind of sun-bleached landscapes, that LA light and the pastels, you know, all the pastels and kind of plexiglass.
Translucency. There's something about the way light travels through a translucent material that feels like both the emulsion itself is being, I mean, maybe this sounds a little mystical, but like the emulsion itself is a translucent material.
Yes.
And when you're seeing the film projected, you're watching light going through a translucent material, and there's just something about images like that. I mean, it makes me want to see, I mean, it makes me want to like watch Three Women on 35 so badly, because that movie's like all, like half of that movie is just randomly shot through one of those like 70s wave machine desk toys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when Nashville came out in the 70s, were there any attempts to recreate it? I can't think of any 70s movies that pulled that off, or 80s movies. Like, they even attempted it.
Oh, did any other directors ever try to do the Robert Altman style?
Yeah.
Well, directly after Altman, I'd say John Sayles really did a lot of, like, big ensemble pieces. Like, there are movies like Parenthood, Grand Canyon, Crash. Like, that's another strain of this. Like, I feel like there's the There's the John Sayles strain, which is like Robert Altman, but like more tightly plotted.
Yeah. And Alan Rudolph also.
Alan Rudolph. Also Tim Robbins, I feel like, who directed that big messy ensemble film about like...
I never saw that.
Cradle Will Rock. Is that movie Bobby that Emilia Estevez directed? Mars Attacks?
Yeah, Mars Attacks.
I mean, that
sure.
was the thing. Watching this film, I was like, it's so interesting to see like Robert Downey Jr. in this movie and then think of him in these gigantic like Marvel films, which have become kind of like 70s disaster pictures, you know? In that kind of Mars Attacks vein of like, it's the Poseidon Adventure. Everyone's invited, you know?
Certainly balancing that amount of characters. Just like, you have 33 story threads. How are you going to fit all that into a movie? Maybe they should have been watching Nashville. Compare and contrast the epigons of this, of Shortcuts, the effect that it had on 90s movie making. Like
Pulp Fiction feels like Shortcuts with guns and more jokes.
And you have Magnolia, obviously.
Which feels like a super jazzed up, like super emotional music video version of Shortcuts.
Yeah, or it's like Scorsese is the Raymond Carver.
The Ask Raymond Carver was so funny because it was just like, hey, I have someone at work who keeps eating my food that I leave in the fridge. Do you think I should leave a note about it or say something to them in person? And the answer is just like, me and Meg stopped by the garage sale and she went inside to look at something and I sat in the car and put my toe in the sand and it felt good to put my toe in sand that felt clean and good like that, right?
Pitch perfect onion non sequitur stuff where someone wrote three amazing paragraphs in the style of Raymond Carver, like kind of credibly. It's like F for Fake, the guy doing the paintings. Like the joke, the only joke is that they match the style credibly. And also that he does not answer the question.
Okay, Jordan, this is a little follow-up from our live show. We're here right by the Flatiron, and we're right by the Hudsucker Clock building.
Do they actually use that?
Well, it's this amalgamation of buildings from the financial district, buildings from right around here, and some buildings from more of Midtown. But that is definitely one of them. I mean, that's the one that the Hudsucker building is based off of most directly.
It looks a lot bigger in the movie than what this it looks like.
Well, that's like three stories tall, Jordan.
Yeah.
Like if you were to stand up there, you'd be, you know, just a little bit taller than that eight, I think.
That is a good, healthy reality check. It's a very big clock.
Really, it's not that big.
Maybe we could do a little Raymond Carver biography corner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Raymond Carver's father was a fisherman and a sawmill worker from Arkansas, as well as a heavy drinker. And his mother was a waitress. So truly working class guy. And his story is one of considerable struggle. Like he met Gordon Lish and was trying to make it as a writer, but was also he got into the Iowa Writers Workshop, but his wife had to basically put off her education in order to try to support him. Ended up not finishing the Writers Workshop. And I think the big thing about reading those stories that felt different from the movie is that his characters are just really counting counting their dollars and cents in like every kind of like every sentence. I think you see that in the Tom Waits and Lily Tomlin storyline the most, for sure. And also in the Chris Penn story, which is based on the vitamin story. The setting and the characters' lives are like a little bit more, like moving it from Northern California to Southern California, you get a more sort of bigger house, suburbs, a little bit more of a bourgeois sensibility. Maybe that's also where Altman's head was at in the 90s.
Yeah, like the previous film was The Player, which is like the most glamorous movie ever made.
Yeah.
And is in the same city, but is just in the most glittering, pristine parts of it.
Yeah.
And so this film is way lower to the ground. And you're right, like the Jennifer Jason Leigh and Chris Penn apartment is awesome. Just the amount of just kind of clutter and this kind of stuff there is everywhere. But yeah, you feel it that like Julianne Moore and Matthew Modine are the richest people in the movie, for sure.
Yeah.
And even other characters are a little uncomfortable when they're over in their house overlooking the city.
And I think it's in the story too that the couple whose kid gets hit by the car, that short story, they're supposed to be a little bit more, I guess, upper middle class. There's a great line in that story about there's a moment where the father, it just says like his life was going perfectly well up until this moment.
I love this too. This super jumped out at me.
Yeah.
There's this whole section where he's talking about the tension of his life is that nothing has really gone wrong yet. And he knows it. That he's just managed to, like, he was born kind of rich. And he really has played by the rules. And so all the scary things that he's heard about happening in a life
haven't happened.
Just haven't really happened to him yet. Yeah. And he's afraid that this is the beginning of it starting to happen.
Yeah. It's so shocking. Again, it's prose. That's like the power of prose is you can do that with, you're not even doing it with a full sentence. You're doing it with like a little piece of a sentence.
Yeah.
I guess it was called hyperlink cinema. Some people called it. Jesus. Almost got hit by a truck. No, not really. Live podcasting, folks. This is the Gonzo hyperlink podcasting.
We're going to play back Jordan's Jesus right here, just to hear what Jordan sounds like when he thinks I'm about to get hit by an 18-wheeler.
I guess it was called hyperlink cinema. Some people called it. Jesus. It's amazing that not only did nobody ever do it better than Altman, but Altman did it as well as you could possibly do it twice. The 23-stranded braid.
Yeah.
Many have attempted it. And I don't think, it's unbelievable to pull that off twice and just be like, yeah, you know, we just shoot all these different stories and then we cut between them and we try to like just keep the tempo and the rhythm of the shots. Like there's almost like an insouciance. It doesn't even seem like he's trying.
Yeah.
In a lot of it. And yet somehow it just plays and plays and plays and plays. And you never get bored. You don't really lose track of it. I lost track a little bit just in terms of like who was whose daughter a few times in this. Especially because I was trying to relate it to the stories.
I was surprised when Huey Lewis showed up later in the film. But I was also surprised when he took his penis out and started peeing on camera.
That's Huey Lewis from Huey Lewis in the News?
Yeah, that's the power of love. And he really hit his mark on peeing, too. Because there's like a zoom shot down from the pee stream, and he's hitting right where the dead body is.
You think that maybe was a VFX rig?
I don't think so.
No?
No, I think it's all there. It's a practical. It's an in-camera.
Yeah.
He handled the stunt himself. Yeah.
It's a penile effect.
But
I think when you tour for that long, you can really do it on command.
Yeah.
It's just, especially if you've toured in Europe. If you've played Glastonbury, you can pee like that.
Yeah. Okay, so let's do just cinema going experience.
Yeah.
The Roxy. I've had a lot of great experiences there. Some with you. I think the last thing we saw there together was that Ryan Tricarton block.
Oh, yeah.
Which was amazing. It was 2 hours of Ryan Tricarton movies. Just massaged our brains.
Unbelievable. It's funny, because I feel like I made the same argument about Tricarton, where it's just like, it's the braid braiding together.
Oh, yeah, your theory of Ryan Tricarton is that it's a triple-stranded braid approach.
Yeah.
Okay, that's beautiful. Yeah. I really love that.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, other big Roxy experiences, I remember, well, first off, seeing my friend Juan's film, The Moth, there recently. It was a great, great experience. And but also seeing Speed Racer on 35mm with a friend of the show, Triple Threat, Alex Sharfman, was amazing to see those beautiful CG graphics.
On film.
On 35mm.
They should do a version of the 4K. They should have one that's just the best possible restoration and one that's just like the most well-preserved 35mm answer print scanned in at 4K where you have that grain and that sheen.
Yeah.
I think that would be fantastic.
There's a guy on the internet that just scans movie trailers at 4K. Like, exactly what you're talking about. Just yeah. like, I want the dirt and I want the cracks, but I want them, like, as crystal clear as I can get them. Yeah.
I get it. We're on Roxy Screening. I had a great time with was In the Mouth of Madness.
Whoa.
With Will Menaker and Hesse doing Q&A
afterwards. Okay. Whoa.
As we get closer to Times Square, I think we're gonna, we may have some.
Oh yeah, we're in the city.
Surprise guests.
It's Wednesday night and the city is dead. Basically, don't you think? It's not a big night in New York. We're at the base of the Empire State Building now. It's 10 o'clock.
I feel great.
Chris Penn is always interesting to watch because you're like, this kind of looks like a more confused Sean Penn.
But is he related to Sean Penn?
It's his brother.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
They look exactly the same.
He died young. So did, and so did Raymond Carver, I guess, to go back to Raymond Carver, like the man. He said that he really liked short stories because you could read them all in one sitting. Mm. And he said he did it partly because he wanted blue collar workers to be able to read them on their breaks. Which I thought was interesting, especially in relation to this movie, which is like taking all those little snacks, those like depressing snacks and putting them all together.
When Tom Waits says, "You're the one chipping away at our mansion of love," to Lily Tomlin, I thought that was a great line. That part where he storms out, he's like, I'm gonna get drunk right now. Drinks the bottle in the driveway and throws it on the ground. He was amazing. His performance was really incredible.
Unbelievable.
Just so fun just to watch him. There's that scene where he gets home and she's not there. And that's when it really sunk in for me, just watching him walk around and try to find someone in an empty house was totally captivating, just through his body language and just because he's a fascinating guy to watch, you know, like pure movie star.
I loved during the earthquake when they get under the door and they say, "This is a big one and we're gonna go out together."
Yeah.
You can't help but feel moved by their relationship. That's pure Altman also. Like, that's so not how any of those stories end.
The story about the waitress and her husband in the book is really just, he sees those guys looking up her skirt and they say, "She doesn't look that good." And so he basically just starts really micromanaging her diet and just weighing her every day and just making sure that she just skips meals. And then she loses a little bit of weight and he goes back to the diner and there's just a guy trying to eat and he's like, "Hey, look at her."
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Exactly. Yeah. He's just bothered that the other guys don't think that she's attractive and just tries to set it right, basically. But that's really his whole arc. It's similar to the Tim Robbins character with the dog. It's, these short stories are really just like one thing happens, a person tries to change one thing in one way, and then the story ends.
A much crueler characterization, not a lot of, not as many sweet undertones compared to Waits and Lily Tomlin, who I think do love each other.
Oh, they're just so charming.
It kind of makes you want to see more adaptations of Raymond Carver.
Well, the other one is that Will Ferrell one, right? Everything Must Go?
I didn't know that.
There's an adaptation of the short story, Why Don't You Dance? That's an awesome story about like a guy who takes all the stuff out of his house and sets it up on the lawn, basically identical to the way that it was inside. Like he connects all the lamps and the record player and the TV. Mm. But it's just got the inside of his suburban house on the lawn and he's getting drunk and this young couple come by and start to like consider buying things and fall asleep on the bed and then he comes out and they all start drinking together and dancing. It's awesome, awesome short story. But they turned it into like a Will Ferrell movie.
Damn, I want to see that. Yeah. That's such a cool image. That story feels like, intentionally or not, some kind of expression of what Carver was doing as a writer. I'm doing this sort of inescapably artistic thing, but also just recreating my life for everyone to see.
Yeah, come like, check it out.
Yeah, come check it out. It's not in a gallery. It's not just on my lawn.
Yeah.
This is all that's in here.
I think that's a sick read, Jordan.
Yeah, having not read the short, having not read the short story, I'm really zhizheking it up on that one. No, but I thought the way you described it was beautiful. I think what's most interesting about a project like this isn't so much the feeling of like, aha, this person was actually this person and they connected in this way. Like, that's very satisfying, and obviously it's been done very well. Like Seinfeld was the Seinfeld, not Jerry Seinfeld, but Seinfeld the show.
What? Seinfeld, not Jerry Seinfeld. Seinfeld the show.
Seinfeld the show. The head writers of Seinfeld. What is it? Okay. That guy, is his name Alec Berg? Or is that the director of Battleship? Their whole thing was the stories have to all tie together.
Yeah.
In an interesting way. And that's what's going to make our show really strong, is that you've had these A, B, and C story plots. And when they come together at the end, it's this sort of like dense collision of all of the different comedy styles that you've watched throughout the episode. And I think this movie does that. But what I think is much more interesting is just the idea that when you take all of these elements from the stories and put them together and have characters overlap or merge, you get some kind of an idea, like a larger idea of who Raymond Carver was as a person and as a writer.
Yeah.
Because obviously when you're making these characters up, you want them to be a simulation of real people. But ultimately, you're basically dreaming and just putting out the ideas that you have in your head. So to try to mount something like this, I think, does do some work that generates a portrait of a body of work. Like, you could do that in a thesis. You could be like, here's 9 stories and here's how the themes all cross over. Or you could do it on a podcast like we do it. But to do it all in a movie that just lives forever as this cohesive narrative work that's all bound together and obviously shot with actors is very powerful.
Yeah, you really do get the interiority, because I feel like you, like Tom Waits and Lily Taylor are both characters that you like a lot for the experience of watching this film, and yet they really, like, she hates him, and you can hold both in your mind at once.
You can hold the playful, extemporaneous vision of these characters that was obviously developed for the movie and the script and in their performances and in their rehearsal. But there's the core of the characters that's, you know, from the original text.
Because you spend time, and it's like what we were talking about in the POV episode, you know, you really spend time with Lily Taylor while she's throwing a party in those people's house.
Yeah.
And you really spend time with Tom Waits when he thinks he's about to die in the big one. Mm. And in both those situations, it's like those are complex characters. It's like they're hurting some people, they're fun and irresponsible, and they're all linked together in these many different ways.
Yeah, it's a chance to make these characters so living, breathing, that they can all hang out with each other.
Yeah.
It's a super group movie.
Yeah, it's like either a disaster links everyone together, it's a superhero movie, or it's like a race, like to go get a big bag of cash. Like it's a Mad Mad World or a rat race, right?
The other thing to compare it to is just like daytime television.
Yeah.
Like there's also just a version of this that never ends.
But what about those like movies that are named after a holiday?
I've never seen those movies. Valentine's Day, New Year's Eve.
Those just have to be like hyper twisted versions of Shortcuts, no?
It's a great pull. I've never seen them, but I have to imagine that they're in some way, I mean, just the same way that Mission Impossible movies are downstream of 70s paranoid thrillers. It's like you have the thing, you have the core idea, you have the psychology, and then you have the refined gem-like product. The lapidary product is still a great word from Ben Brewer.
Okay, so we are really in Times Square now.
Yeah, speaking of New Year's Eve. Mouth of Madness is the Carpenter film, right?
Definitely.
Okay. I was getting confused with Heart of Darkness or... Heart of Darkness is the documentary about Apocalypse Now.
There's Heart of Darkness is the book the Apophis now is based off of, and Hearts of Darkness is the dock. Megadock is a really funny name for Megalopolis.
It's an amazing name.
That would be like calling it Hearts of Darkness or something. You know, it's just like...
That's just the name of the sequence in Premiere.
Megadock.
And it's and it's stuck. That's my hot take. Just one last thing just about that movie is just felt like everybody was basically in the 80s or even the 70s, but then Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Penn were just solidly in the 90s with their costumes.
Robert Downey Jr.'s whole physical presence with his shorts and his weirdly tense, sweaty body. It was like his tensed up shoulder muscles and...
Just 1993 as a person.
So funny.
Yeah. His shoulder muscles were like spelling out 1993.
Okay, so segueing out of Shortcuts and as we're approaching the theater where we're going to see Send Help in 4DX, any possible connections? Both renegade directors, right? With their own style.
Yeah. The titles are similar. Shortcuts, Send Help.
Okay, yeah.
Two words, one syllable each.
I feel like we're gonna get like a, you know, the human condition is very at the forefront.
Yeah.
Survival.
They're both in 3D.
But yeah, I'm such a huge Sam Raimi fan and just so excited to see him make another film about like a human character set in a human world that then ratchets up to extreme violence.
I think it's gonna be a Sam Raimi joint.
Yeah.
Through and through. I'm also excited that it's in 3D. The amount of 3D releases we're getting these days are not enough. I did actually catch one of the last screenings of Predator Badlands in 3D.
Wow.
It wasn't the greatest screen, but it was cool just to see like some of the choices they were making. Everybody, before you watch Send Help or after, go see Twinless. Streaming now, I think. Dylan O'Brien is amazing in Twinless, so I have high expectations.
Okay, so we're about to go inside the Regal and see Send Help.
In 4DX.
In 4DX.
New York City, baby. It's our year.
I'm going to be frank with you. You are smart. I know that you are great with numbers, but I just don't think you got it. As an executive, I see no value in you. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, what?
You know we have the Bangkok merger coming up. Prove me wrong. Oh, Linda, before you go, I forgot to mention I've received a few complaints about you.
Complaints?
Noxious odors.
Oh, God. Yes.
Take your seats, you're a little bitch.
Who's joined the land of the living?
How long?
Have you been out? Day and a half?
Have you tried making a distress signal?
Or a bigger fire?
I was busy trying to keep us alive.
But getting us out of here, that should be your focus. Not being Susie Homemaker over here.
What did you just say to me?
Let's not forget, I'm your boss. You work for me.
We're not in the office anymore, Bradley. No help is coming. You just have to accept that this is how things are now. Your hunt. I think I like it. You are stuck with an asshole boss. Just like I was. Although I'm betting I am a much nicer boss than you ever would have been. Except for maybe this part. I don't think we should ever leave.
Quick editor's note, Ray's mic is going to be muffled for the next 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and then it's back to normal. Thanks for being a listener.
We are walking down the escalator.
Jordan, that's the biggest 40-inch screen I've ever seen in my life.
You know, my experience with 4DX has been exclusively at the Union Square 14, the Times Square 42nd Street. It takes it up a notch.
They just redid this thing. There was maybe four other people in the theater, but it's this massive 4DX.
Felt like it was designed for 4DX, didn't it?
The 4DX was so light, though, didn't you? It was like...
It was modulated.
I think that they were only using the 4DX for about, like, 1/6 of that movie.
I would say more, maybe 25%.
25%?
Yeah. They had a Wizard of Oz-esque use of the 4DX. You don't feel anything until the plane explodes.
Yeah, the turbulence, it was like a really, really intense turbulence hit.
Yeah.
And then the plane crash is just bananas.
To the White Sea-esque?
Oh yeah, virtuosic plane crash sequences are the best. The Fight Club, Castaway, and every director, Flight, you know, every director puts their own little signature on it, and this was incredible. Sam Raimi, the crash sequence.
A lot of suddenly zombified faces flying into view in 3D.
I feel like that was really what he brought to the table. It was just like, oh my God, there'd be so many like bloody gross people turning into, like walking dead people in front of your eyes.
Yeah, I don't think this movie was shot stereoscopically. I do think that it was shot with 3D in mind. Do you think either of the lead actors was ever on an island or on a beach?
It seemed like they filmed in Thailand based off the credits at the end.
Right.
But yeah, I wonder how much of this is a reproduced beach. Like, you know, you can go to the island from Castaway for sure. And they spent a lot of that movie taking boats out to that island.
Yeah.
But a lot of that movie is also just him playing around with CG rocks and CG waves and stuff. So I'd imagine it's kind of similar.
Totally. I mean, maybe that's the way you build a film production company in Thailand, is you just have a bunch of beach and then also 20,000 foot soundstage that's just equipped to truck in some sand.
It was fun though. I mean, like the part where they're climbing up that big mountain and it looks like, it just looks like a cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, or it looks like a mountain from He-Man or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Or Moana. I liked it though. I actually felt like that looked like a really beautifully built set.
Yeah, I just like, we're on like King Kong Island right now. You know, we're on Castaway Island. Those big crossed rocks were so fake. But I mean, honestly, it was basically the geographical layout of the island from Castaway with the peak on the corner like that and the beach and the little higher area. They basically copied the terrain. But basically, I would sum up the 4DX use on this film as there was a lot of times where tilts and pans would give you a kind of vertigo, kind of falling
like
forward
a
feeling.
Weightlessness, kind of.
Yes, a weightlessness with panning. Then otherwise extreme restraint. When the shit hit the fan, there was a general just kind of, we were being thrown around for the duration of like big surprising jump moments. This is kind of general, like everything is being tossed in every direction at once, kind of.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like a lot of the bloodiest moments, they would spray water on you. I do feel like that kind of sums up the 4DX experience, but it was very restrained. They really only used it in moments where the story totally necessitated that you be like thrown up in the air.
Yeah.
Jordan had ordered nachos, which he successfully ate with.
Ray noted that I was holding a tray of a very flimsy cardboard nacho container over a pure white shirt. And that this was really asking for trouble. And he took a picture of me, which I'm sure is really flattering, of me holding the nachos, getting ready to get...
Slimed,
yeah. And, but I did my diligence and I basically just housed them before anything started moving. That was how that went.
But in general, loved the 3D, really felt like the 3D added a tremendous amount to the... just the way it was shot and the kind of visceral pops of it.
100%. Like, we are bigging up the 4DX experience because that's what we saw, but in general, I think you get 90% of what we experienced you'll get that just from the 3D. I really liked Rachel McAdams' performance in this.
Oh yeah, it was incredible.
She was frumped up, I think, to a degree that I was expecting, but also that got pushed to a level that was also surprising.
She was real hunched over. Yeah. She had great posture work.
Cinematically unflattering. There was a cinematic approach to the way that she was photographed, especially in the first half of the film.
Well, they made her hair really greasy in a great way. It was that similar to the fake-looking mountains. You know, it's that thing of like one of the most photogenic people ever just being kind of like scuffed up a bit, you know?
Yeah.
But what I was surprised by, and can we get into spoiler territory here?
Sure. Okay. If you don't want Send Help spoiled, fast forward to the end of the podcast now.
Okay. This movie is a lot more like Misery than I thought it was going to be. The big thing that I think was left out of the advertising campaign was just that she was going to have an opportunity to get off the island fairly early on in the film and would choose to stay to preserve the kind of Stockholm Syndrome situation going on.
Maybe how much that plot element was revealed may have been like a question. What would this movie have been like if that reveal only happened at the end?
I think it was more fun this way.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Just to let you in
on the
game. Because there was still twists, like the twist that there was a mansion on the island. You know, there was other stuff to be delivered.
She does some bad stuff in this movie.
But no, it was exciting. Mean, that was exciting. They said it was much more of a... She's much more of an anti-hero.
Yeah, I was flashing back to our episode on unforgivable protagonists. One of the things we learned from McKee and Save the Cat, dude, is put the unlikable protagonist next to someone who's worse.
Yeah.
And this movie definitely plays that game very well. At whatever turn that she is betraying him or betraying kind of their immediate ability to be out of the situation, he is sort of constantly meeting her in terms of just very bad, bad boss behavior, bad attitude, his own trickery. Also thinking about POV. Did you notice the first time we got into his POV?
Was it when she left him alone on the beach?
Totally,
right?
We
didn't know where she was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was great, because that was like, that was a real Sam Raimi horror sequence, and suddenly the character that we were having all these questions and mystery about was our main character, who we had been with, like, so lockstep the entire film. And I thought that was really exciting.
Yeah. The extent to which when she goes off and does stuff, we are with her, or then totally not with her, makes it a weird film.
Yeah, you really get what it's like to be terrorized by both these characters. Also, I love that CG pig. CG animals maybe get a bad rep in movies. That thing was outrageously cool.
That pig was great.
It had great performance, you know? It was just sputtering and kicking, and it was just so, like, alive at every single moment. It's just, I ever see, like, anyone who wants to be like, what should a CG animal look like in a movie, even if it's going to look kind of fake? Like, what? How can you overcome that just with pure performance? It's incredible. Yep.
I was getting shades of the goat in Drag Me to Hell. This was in a lot of ways Drag Me to Hell.
Oh, yeah.
Part two.
Especially the opening, just with the inter-office job promotion stuff.
Right.
It's almost like exactly the dynamic of the first film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Except she prevailed. and you are expecting, I think,
a comeuppance.
There might be a comeuppance, especially after Drag Me to Hell.
No, she just gives that look right into the camera. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Those kinds of beats, I mean, I love, there's a shot of her screaming when she's on the airplane right before it hits the water.
Yeah.
And basically it goes into this, like, everything goes black and there's almost just like a spotlight on her, and it looks super old-timey horror film.
Yeah.
And the camera like zooms in on her. That was incredible. That beat where the fiance suddenly turns into like a floor goblin from Evil Dead 2.
So gnarly. It's like, it's just, it feels like Raimi is almost auditioning to be like, hey, if you want to do a horror movie, like, I still like this stuff a lot.
Just the pure ecstasy and like the total truth of that moment. We're like, standing next to her, and that camera move that goes along with it. It's just, it's the goods, you know?
I was thinking about old, the beach that makes you old.
It's a lot, yeah, very much so. Similar, like, crazy CG rocks and stuff, but a bunch of actors on the beach.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask you, what did it feel like to watch this film after watching Shortcuts?
Great question, Ray. It felt like film is amazing. Film is alive. Every filmmaker defines film on their own terms.
Yeah.
It's another Janine piece of knowledge. And I feel that watching these two movies.
Well, they're both like return to form films. Can we say that?
Yeah.
Send Help and Shortcuts. They're both masters from previous eras.
Yes.
Who've maybe like, you know, had some near hits and maybe gone astray a little bit, but coming back to something that really reminds you of their earlier work, feels vital again, but is new, is different.
I couldn't have said it better.
These are late period Renaissance projects.
I was also thinking Frances McDormand could have played this role.
Oh, would have been incredible.
Like pretty much any shot in this
incredible movie. My God.
And also because her name is Linda, like Linda Litsky from Burn After Reading.
Yeah. Who would you cast in the boss role? From the Coen stable.
I mean, Dan Hedaya comes to mind, but let's just...
you just want to do Blood Simple on the beach, basically.
Basically, yeah. Beach Simple. like who's like a cutie pie who could also be that menacing? It's tough because the Coens, like, male leads are usually, like, sort of not that vital. Paul Newman.
That's great. Paul Newman just playing Sidney Musburger.
Yeah.
Crashed on the island.
But Dylan O'Brien's age.
What do you feel is the best 4DX, like the best marriage of form and content 4DX you've ever seen?
Well, I do have this fantasy of playing Edward 4DX, which is just Edward 40 hands in a 4DX. And I think and Edward Scissorhands playing on the screen in 3D. I think that would be just perfect.
Edward 4DX hands.
Yes. I'm trying to think. What were the really good ones?
For me, like Fast and Furious and Top Gun. Just ones that were very vehicle based.
I did see Top Gun in 4DX and it was very good. That's a good call.
I remember in Top Gun, they spend so much of that film explaining that route that they have to fly. They have to fly through that canyon and then they have to go hug really close to that mountain as they're going up and then fly down it like a roller coaster. And they just spend so much of the movie like running that at an alternate location so that by the time they get to that final sequence, you're just like riding that roller coaster with them.
Yeah.
And I do remember, that was pretty thrilling when they take that final drop down on that roller coaster at the end. That was great.
It's giving you it's not just the sense, but it's the sense memory of earlier scenes.
Yeah, because that's a movie about them practicing a ski run, basically, and then doing that.
I was thinking about POV and how it relates to how 4DX is related to POV. Because if someone's getting thrown around or gets stabbed and then they do the like lumbar support jab, that is definitely putting you in their point of view. I think that might be partly why the movie holds back so much, is because they don't want you to pick a side or identify too much with O'Brien.
Yeah. This theater had the full smoke bombs going off underneath the screen too, which I really do appreciate. It's always nice to look down and it looks like they're boiling a pot of soup.
I always like the lightning flashes too.
Yeah.
A tasteful 4DX rendering. For a movie that is basically already in 4DX, no matter how you see it. What'd you think about the final message of the movie? Help is not coming, so you better start saving yourself. Wink to camera. Was that a Trump 2 political statement?
Like, we're stuck on this island. called America, and we're here with our bad boss, who's this like hot 20-year-old guy named Donald Trump, right? Is that what we're laying down?
We're stuck here with the Trumpists. But then again, she's kind of like Trump because they might not let go. They might keep us here longer than we need to. Yeah, she's basically the Democrats.
Okay. She's just like, let's just keep this going because I like the tension of this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like the feeling. I like the feeling of holding your survival over your head, even though like obviously there's a mansion on the other side of this island that we've been living in.
So are we like the fiance then? We're just hoping for the best and trying to help. And we're never gonna get what we want.
Yeah, I think we're the bore, maybe.
I loved when she was giving him CPR and she kept vomiting on him. I mean, you have to just be like, that's like one of the absolute best parts of the movie.
In general, like once we're in psycho, evil, dead, throw stuff at you mode, there's always at least one beat that extra than you think like after it's over. Yeah. And probably like three or four beats.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know if Raimi does in other movies. I would imagine he does.
I think he does.
But it's like the boar definitely dies three times. She pukes.
It's just
a good few times.
It's the happiest way of feeling because you and me are just like, you're just sitting next to each other going like, no, no, oh my God. And you like can't believe that it's happened. And then it keeps happening. I don't know how to just, it's like you have the joy of having gotten through it together and then it's still going on, you know?
I think a lot of horror movies are all about the buildup.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, they started doing a fake out.
Yeah.
And now it feels like it's mostly fake outs. And then when they actually give it to you, you feel like, I could have had a little bit more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe the horror is just a little too elevated or the filmmakers are like afraid of their own power or something. But Raimi's just been doing this long enough where he's like, no, I can like, it's sloppy Joe night.
Yeah, it just feels like someone playing in the mud, you know, just like splatting around.
I think the actors had a good time with this. That's my read. Like as much as this movie has extremity to it, I don't feel like they were making Sorcerer on this set. Like I think even O'Brien's performance is almost towing the line of I'm an actor having fun, but actually in a great way. I think it keeps the movie on its toes. And also he's a sarcastic person. Like that's like kind of how he deals with this. Like his superpower is him just being like, I'm not actually in trouble right now.
Okay, so we got into 22nd Street and this is really entering I Am Legend type Vanilla Sky.
Vanilla Sky my was what I was gonna say.
Completely empty, asleep New York City.
What did you think about Linda's survival skills and cooking skills in this movie?
Oh, it's so fun to watch. I mean, in Castaway, they just kind of justify him being good at surviving on the island because he is a systems analyst type thinker. But in this one, they add that she's been studying to be on Survivor. I liked how much they were like, Castaway already did the work of setting up all the stakes of this stuff. We can just play. Like, even when he makes the break to escape on the raft, all the tension of him getting past those waves is exactly how it plays out. It's like, okay, now he's in the last scene from Castaway.
Yeah.
Can he beat that? Those series of three waves that Tom Hanks had to beat.
This film bears relation to Castaway, much as Malignant bears relation to Fight Club. Have you seen that movie?
For sure.
The music hit with the Pixies. So it's like looking directly in the camera, but through music.
It's really funny.
It would have been sweet at Nighthawk if they had done a whole spread. Like a
sashimi.
The haute cuisine.
Uh-huh.
Version of 40X would be Sushi X.
Yeah.
Everybody, when this movie enters secondary markets, we're doing
40X on the beach.
Send help, tapas. Small plates.
Centapas.
Centapas, yes. We're at 18th Street now.
How about this? Can we draw connections between Rachel McAdams in this story and Fred Ward, Buck Henry, and Huey Lewis in Shortcuts?
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to stop the trip.
Yeah.
They want the trip to keep going.
Absolutely, yes.
What kind of human beings are they?
Yes. Human beings who know what it means to do a getaway.
I feel like that's the strongest actual connection I can make. Is that, you know, you've gone all the way out there. You have a tent. You're on the water. And you, there's a reason to go home. And you say, you know, against everything, every strain of goodness I have in my body, I'm staying here. I'm going to see this through.
Do we have it? Do we even have a cellular phone?
Yeah.
You think I have one of those Orbis cellular phones? Were you thinking about who was watching her bird?
I was thinking about who was going to feed her bird. It was great that the bird looked so strange so that when it showed up at the end, you were like, that's the same bird.
I think Robert Downey Jr. and Lily Taylor were feeding that bird. They pushed the envelope with the romantic subplot like exactly as far as it wanted to go, I think.
There was many beats, there was many fade to blacks that ended purely on their relationship just growing stronger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think my favorite shot in the movie is that extremely long push-in pseudo-helicopter shot that ends with them on higher ground making the shelter together.
Yeah.
Just like, that's why you get Raimi with a steady hand, just being like, no, this shot should be three times as long as you think it should be.
I think it was nice to see Shortcuts on 35 just because it was so stimulating in this kind of low-tension way the entire time. Just it looked so complex and the characters were so complex. And it had this nice kind of glacial pacing, but so much incredibly devastating stuff was happening and incredibly funny stuff was happening in every scene. And it just held us just right there at that tempo that I think we needed to be. Whereas like going to see Send Help, sitting on a pneumatic seat that was just basically throwing you in the air every time the story got exciting, it just gave you like the most jaggedy, bouncy experience possible. So it was just really fun to like experience a long, sustained burn and then just basically being thrown into a bag of candy and shaken up.
Especially the order and the time of day that we saw it. Very important that we saw the 3-hour movie first and then saw the movie that literally would not let us fall asleep. Two movies where I was continuously going, how did they make this?
Yeah. Yeah.
How is this constructed to keep the flow going? Well, Ray, I just want to say,
that was a great double feature.
That was a delight.
Yeah, I really loved every minute of that.
A real pleasure.
I feel like we were taken to the ultimate ends of human experience and shown just beautiful images that I'll take with me.
Who talks about virtual reality in,
I think it was Jennifer Jason Leigh?
Yeah.
Was it Jennifer Jason Leigh talking about virtual reality?
Yeah.
Yeah, what'd she say?
Virtual reality. It's almost exactly like reality. But it's virtual. I felt that. I felt that from Robert Altman and I felt that from Sam Raimi very much. So, well, thanks for joining us on this journey.
Thanks everyone for going to the movies with us.
See both these movies. However and wherever you can.
The only place to watch Shortcuts right now is on YouTube. And Send Help is like reigning triumphant at the box office right now. We love this movie.
We love you.
We love you so much and we'll see you on the next episode of To the White Sea.
Goodbye. Have a good one. Good night. Send Help.
Yes, I knew why. He's a real good one for a man. Or jump in the lake.
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sriskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music written and performed by Dan Romer.
Sweet talking like a fish in the sea. Tell me a story.
catch me a trap. Man is a liar, a man is a fool, playing for keepers.